everything is working fine. Nice. And Dean, you look a lot younger in person than you do on your sort of LinkedIn profile. So you know, life is treating you well, it seems.
I've got a good filter on.
I didn't say that about me, Dean. Say that.
You know, I didn't. Dan. I think you and me need a bit of work, or we need to have that filter, because it is scary how good you can get, like a younger filter, can't you? Where it literally like takes away the creases in the crow's feet disappear and stuff like this, and it's like, holy crap, that actually makes a difference, and no one can tell. Anyway,
that's my
folks.
Next Google.
Yeah. Anyway, folks, we are live. So welcome everybody to Founders Focus. This is our first Founders Focus of the year. This is the show where we get up close and personal with the people who are making the technology products that are changing the way in which we work today. And I'm always excited to do this show because I really enjoy speaking with people who are building businesses and building products for, you know, the community that we love to address. I think a lot of us who are users of technology, recruiting technology, we like to complain a lot about it. We're never satisfied about what the tool is providing with us. It's really important for us, I think, to understand what is involved in terms of building not only a great product, but a profitable business that can continue to survive and sustain even through the tough times. So this week, I'm delighted to introduce our friends at Tripad. It's Dan Kirkland and Dean Sadler. So Dan and Dean, welcome to the show.
Hello.
Hi, everyone.
Great to see you two. So you two are obviously very busy people managing, leading this technology business. What important like founder stuff did you have to cancel in order to appear on Founders Focus today?
Well, I'm missing the greatest comedy show on TV right now, which is Prime Minister's Question Time.
Right. Is he actually on? Did he turn up?
I don't know.
Good Lord. For the folks who don't know, obviously, this is like the nadir moment for Mr. I call him King Boris now, because he operates as if he is above the law. So I'm actually campaigning for us to crown Boris Johnson the King of England. Because if the law doesn't apply, then, you know, let's formally make him a monarch. I think he should be right up there. Okay, how about you, Dan? What did you have to cancel to appear on the show?
I was going to have a meeting with my commercial director and our CFO.
Give yourself a nice meeting. Give yourself a nice raise or something. The founders are due a dividend.
Yeah.
Listen, I really appreciate your time. I mean, another reasons why I'm kind of I consider this moment precious, because I know how important it is to the business to take two senior people out to have this conversation. So I really do appreciate it. Let's rewind the clock. Oftentimes we encounter products, we encounter these amazing brands, we use them, we don't know where they came from. What is the origin story of this? Like, how did the Tripad idea emerge? Who came up with it? What was the, you know, when was the spark where you knew it was going to be a thing? Dean, do you want to give this one a shot?
Yeah, it's quite, it didn't start off as being Tripad. We started off a company called Talent on View, which was a video interviewing platform back in 2008. The kernel of that was, previously I was CTO of PlusNet. We grew from a handful of people to 760 by the time we sold it to BT, and recruitment was our biggest problem. So we thought video interviewing technology would be, you know, great. We built the technology, and we were just too early to the market. Although broadband, you know, was a thing, we found that infrastructure inside businesses wasn't up to the task, or there were just so many IT logistical headaches. We tried that for 2 years and then pivoted in 2010. And we pivoted basically on the conversation with one of our clients at the time. And they said, look, the ATS marketplace is broken. You know, you guys can fix it. I was like, okay, we'll give that a go. And that's how it started.
That's amazing. And coming from a CTO perspective, so you've had experience of building products before in the past. You saw a personal issue, like you saw yourself like struggling to hire, you thought video interviewing was the technology. You are right, you're 10 years ahead, too far. The overall the broadband wasn't there to support a good experience. You look at how we are now, we're all kind of working. I think you and I are home, Dean. Dan looks as if he's in an office somewhere, but we're kind of like pretty much relying. It's reliable to have really good quality internet, and you can actually have a great experience on video, but it's taken a long time for us to get here, hasn't it? I remember speaking really early on to companies, even two years after you guys pivoted, and it was still a big chew to get it done at that point. How about you, Dan? Like, when did you interact with Dean, and when did that sort of meeting sort of start happening?
Yeah, actually, interesting. Dean and I go back a long time. I worked at PlusNet, managing the platform and infrastructure teams under Dean at the time. And just before PlusNet got bought by BT, I'd already decided I was going to step out and finally set up my own business. It'd been something I'd always wanted to do, and set up a tech business. Actually built a gig economy platform back then, which is another story in its own right. But Dean, similarly, you know, he didn't really want to work for a big corporate company. And so when PlusNet got bought, Dean left, and I was kind of already half out. And we've always kind of got on and seen the world from similar eyes. I think we're both techies, so we've got a lot of skills that are in common, but we've got skills that are in that complement each other as well. So when we had a chat after he left and I would already kind of got my feet mostly out the door, we had a chat about recruitment software in general, and that was in his living room at the time. And then we started working pretty much the following week together.
Fantastic. Let's talk about the techie side of it. I think it's actually quite unusual in the modern day to have two technical people founding a technical business. Usually they say, oh, you know, you need the techie guy, this person's going to do that. And then, oh, where's the salesperson? You need to drop that person in, he needs to do this. Like, what do you think gives a team that is heavily technical an advantage against teams that have that mix? And what do you have a disadvantage compared to that type of configuration early days? Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think in the early days, we were very much a technology business. You know, sales and marketing were, you know, a distant thought. And we just thought, let's just go and solve some problems. I will caveat that I'm not a very good techie. You know, Dan's far better than me. I was more into chip design, and I kind of fell into software development through PlusNet. So, it kind of, he's far better than me, and I kind of just steer towards more of the business side.
Right, very interesting. I think one of the experiences I've got, so I kind of set up a business a couple of years ago as well, had two techie co-founders. And I was a sales guy, obviously. And basically what I found was that we just end up, it's hard to do the stuff you don't like to do. And you end up just steering even subconsciously towards the stuff you do like to do.
What happens today?
Yeah, so you end up like, I think sometimes you're going to overbuild. Like, I definitely think we overbuilt because we end up building a full app without even getting any funding or whatever. And it was like, oh, crap. You know, we really should have raised some money there. If you're aware of that, how do you, like, make sure you don't oversteer? Is there a mechanism for you to make sure that you're not, like, over-engineering and constantly building?
I think we're better at it these days. I think what you just described definitely described Dean and myself, you know, 10, 12 years ago. But I think we are getting better at it through, you know, experience of the failures that we have of, you know, we thought that'd be a really good idea and then people not using it or whatever. So I think we learned our lesson probably the wrong way. You know, through experience, through recruiting other people around us as well, giving us a more rounded thought process. You know, I think it's only recently we've actually recruited a proper what we'd call CFO and a, you know, commercial director a few years ago. It took us a while and it took us some mistakes to get there.
Yeah, so I think it's some of those things that I think you never learn without having it's almost experiential learning, isn't it? It's like you can't really just get it out of a book, even though you know it and you've read it out of a book. It's like, no, you have to kind of get the rough stuff in before you figure this out. Whenever anybody's starting a business and building technology, there's always a moment where you think, is it going to work? Isn't going to work? Or is it not going to work? Looking back at it now, was there a moment in the build process really early on where you thought, you know what, we have something here? Was it a case where that question didn't arise? Like, can you pick that one up for us?
We've got loads of situations like that. We were in the fortunate position where we had a client before we actually had a product. And that kind of helped us define what we wanted to build or what they wanted us to build.
Right.
So we're very fortunate there. We didn't go and build something, say, if we build it, they will come. We did the complete opposite. And we've continued to do that. So we listen to the customers and they drive the development roadmap. The latest one for me is probably at the beginning of COVID. And I'm constantly surprised. In the last 10, 12 years, I've been constantly surprised on what we've been able to achieve. But at the beginning of COVID, the first weekend, we had one of our clients advertise. This is when all the supermarkets were pretty much closed or big queues outside. And one of our clients advertised for 40,000 delivery drivers over the next 8 weeks. And in that weekend, we had 860,000 people apply for those jobs. So huge amounts of job applications going through the platform. And the platform coped admirably, but the graph was just amazing. You know, it was just like, right, here's normal. And then all of a sudden, bang. And to this day, I just sit there and go like, that was amazing in terms of what the guys in this business built. You know, supremely proud of.
Yeah, sometimes you like, again, it's not testable, is it? I mean, you can simulate it, but to actually in production where things need to happen and it succeeds, it doesn't fall over, that is a great achievement. It basically means that the engineering is just rock solid. So we should hope so, even with bad engineer like you, Dean. But you know, if you've got two engineers at the top, you would hope that one part that isn't lacking is that the technology piece should be solid, because it empowers. I think one of the advantages of having a very technical founding team is that at least the early decisions that you make that can often determine the pathway as to how what kind of business you've got, you should be a little bit more competent in doing that with a little bit more confidence, I would say, than a non-technical founding team. I know that, you know, there's a lot of people that are from the business side, and they want to build technology, but they don't know. And hiring even the first technical person that they don't know is like the biggest challenge, because how do they actually commit that heavily to a CTO co-founder that they don't actually know? How do they even assess that person, because they're not competent to do so? And, you know, how much trust you just like if as soon as you bring them on, you've moved like 50% of the executive decision making to this person that you may not have known 2 weeks ago or however long it was. So it is a huge challenge the other way as well. Okay, let's talk about sort of the early sort of building the team around you. So you're building this thing, you got a customer, you know, you've got some business security there. What was like in your mind, like who the first hire is going to be? I mean, you know, when the revenue was coming in, the opportunity did start to emerge. What kinds of people did you feel was necessary to bring into that team at that point? Was there any particular role or any particular function you wanted to cover early on?
Well, early on, it was all software development and network engineering capability. I mean, we were fortunate because our previous company, PlusNet,
you know, gives you a massive,
So we took some of the guys that we liked and we had respect for, and we said, you know, come and work with us. We think we've got a really interesting proposition here, and we think we're going to have some fun doing it. So they were the early guys. And we have a policy of, you know, we only recruit people that we like, okay, that we think that we can get on with, that have the same belief and value system to us. And then we grew from there. You know, the first 3 years of this business was run from my dining room table. You know, and at lunchtime, I would cook on the barbecue or cook pizzas. And the only reason we got an office is one of our clients wanted to come in, do a audit to make sure that we were a real company with a real office. And secondly, and more importantly, my wife was getting fed up that that her dining room table was our office. So we moved, and that's how, you know, that's how we progressed. Everything was done. We bootstrapped. We didn't take any investment from anybody. It's our cash in this business. There's no external shareholders, etc.
Is that still the case, Dean?
Still the case.
Wow, that's amazing. That is actually amazing. Yeah. But I tell you something. What you're telling us here is that there's a different pathway to success. Because a lot of people listening to this, I think people who kind of tune into Founders Focus in, you know, various means, a lot of them have the inclination of maybe becoming a founder one day or doing some recruitment technology. You know, they have that inclination, and all the time they're being told, you know what, you have to go raise money, you have to go VC route, you have to do this, this, and this. But actually you're saying, you know what, sometimes you might actually find a situation where the revenue early on is powered by a customer has made a request that they can't get anywhere else. And if you've got the engineering chops to build that, then that may actually help fuel not only the product development, but to keep the cash flow into the business. You can grow from that base rather than go external money and, you know, give away your shareholding. You know, I mean, a lot of people go through the fundraising, raise like large numbers, but the founders themselves might end up with fairly small chunk of that at the end, which is, you know, sometimes a sad thing to witness, where, you know, this person has put in like blood, sweat, and tears for a long time, and they've walked away with, in the end, not too much. So the benefits of not raising is that you own everything. What are the negatives of that? Thoughts on this? Because that's also consideration that I think all C-level people might need to think about. Have we got enough capital to actually grow? What's the things that you need to think about as a business at your level?
Yeah, I think in the early days, capital constraints can pretty much dictate your roadmap and what you want to develop. You know, and there's pros and cons to that. The pros are you have to really seriously think about what you're going to build. If you're not flush with cash, you build the important and urgent stuff. You're not buying fancy chairs and fancy desks. You're focusing on the product. That obviously has its constraints insofar as, well, actually, if you've got this much demand, but you can only deliver this much, then it's going to take longer to get there. So it's a balancing act for sure. But again, I'm a big believer in the best time to take money is when you don't need it. You know, you get better terms and, you know, you're in control of the scenario as opposed to the person giving you the money.
Yeah, I think that product discipline is a really good point because I've worked in businesses that are raised, I thought, too much money and they were under pressure. I was the recruiter coming into that. And The point where I realized that we'd raised too much money was when the developers I was hiring were coming to me and saying, "Hung, I got nothing to do." It's like I'm sitting there. I actually don't know what I'm doing. There isn't anything for me to build. What should I do? And I'm thinking, yeah, but I've been told to hire another 20 of you. So what's going on? Basically, they raised a bunch of money and they want me to keep like putting these engineers in, but actually, you know, there was no product discipline. We didn't know what was required. So, but when you're really don't have the resources, you have to make the trade-offs and you have to say, you know what, if we build A, we cannot build B. We don't have the resources to it. Is this the better choice? And that's where the only real decision-making in terms of product building is concerned. Cool. What about this concept of CPOs? These days, it's quite cool. Like one of the cooler jobs, I guess, in, you know, technology businesses is, you know, chief product officer and stuff like this. There's even a discipline and community around that. But that is not a figure that's in Tripad. That's still sort of the founding team is still the visionaries, the product owners of steering the ship, so to speak. Do you see that as a persistent thing going forward? Or do you think at some point, maybe we do need product person, we step back, do something focused, our energies in a different place?
It's actually really interesting you've asked that question, because, I mean, for the first, up until late last year, it was primarily me and Dean being that product owner. But as Dean said, we've always been a customer driven. We do like to create, with techies, but we've always been a customer driven company. And, we want to solve the problems for customers. So we've always generally owned the product, but we actually promoted somebody late last year into a product ownership role. And that's the first time, it's been someone other than myself and Dean, which takes a lot of the pressure off us, to be honest. This person's worked with customers since they started with us about four or five years ago. So they know our customers, they know our product, they know our business. Quite frankly, I think they'll do a better job than I was doing, as it being, one of many jobs that I was doing. That's their main job now. So I think it's good for Tripad. It's good for the product.
Yeah. And also this person's already got institutional knowledge as in terms of how you work. They understand already, if they've been there 4 years, they've got all of that going on. They understand how things get shipped in the business. And they understand the customer base. It should be like a kind of high value, low risk type of move. I think a CPO from the outside in is probably one of the highest risk moves you can make, isn't it? Because you have to empower that person for them to be effective. But hey, it's your baby, isn't it? It's like, you've looked after this.
We did advertise externally, and we interviewed a number of people. But for reasons you were alluding to, they don't have. You never found someone who ticked enough boxes. They either knew the industry but never did product management, never did any project management, but they knew the industry, or they used to be a recruiter. Whereas recruiting within, they've worked with us as product owners. They've worked with our customers, who are the most important in helping us define roadmaps. And they understand the customers and the business too. So, it was actually an easier decision than we thought. After we'd interviewed everybody, we'd interviewed a lot of people, and it was obvious to us who the best candidate was all along, and they were sat next to us.
Yep. And sometimes you need to have actually external comparators kind of just highlight sort of the possibilities of that internal hire, particularly if it's a reasonably small business and you've had lots of experience with the internal person. You often stop thinking about them in a particular role, because you're very attached to this person performing in this role, and you need to have actually them going through a process before you can see it. Michael, Blakely, thank you for your questions. We'll get to them at the end. So folks, if you have any questions, please do ask the question at the bottom of the screen. We'll get to those. There's some really good questions already down there. Let's talk about leadership lessons, folks, because both of you had leadership lessons before you launched Tripad. So I want to even take this even before, the Tripad era, so to speak. The things that you've picked up over time that you think are really valuable lessons for you as a leader. Like if I was a young person going into a leadership position, what kind of insight can you give from your experience that this person needs to know in order to be an effective leader? Thoughts on this? Dean, go you first.
Yeah, so the thing that I think is probably the most important thing, and it's the thing that I find the most difficult, is listening. So lots of people, want to give their opinion, especially in a meeting situation, you want to give your opinion and you want to, you want to say, here's the problem, here's the solution I've come up with. And it took me a long time, and I'm still not particularly great at it. Okay. I think there's a lot of work still to do in just being the last person to talk. Let everybody else have their input and get that collective thought process really working before you open your mouth. I find that difficult to do, but I'm actively trying to do that. And if I'd have done that a lot earlier, things would have been a lot easier.
You know, that's a really important bit of leadership insight there. And I'm already kind of thinking why that might be. Obviously, as the leader, the things you say carry a different weight to everyone else. So if you're like coming in there and you're straight away being the first person to speak, everyone's going to kind of modify or moderate their own input based on what they've heard from you. So you do have to shut the beep up. Like the last thing, the last person to speak should be you. Your job is to encourage everyone else to voluntarily come up with their unadulterated, unmodified opinions. Then your job is to come out with a verdict. I think that's a really important leadership lesson. Again, part of the reason why I love Founders Focus is because I don't think you normally get this type of insight from a management book often. You need to gone through it and live through it. As you said, Dean, you know, maybe there's moments where you've realized that, oh, you know, you've altered the tenor of the conversation by coming in too early with an opinion. And that's not served the business. How about you, Dan? Any leadership insights that you've picked up in your time?
It's interesting. You mentioned management books, and over my my years, I've read a lot of different management books. But the most important lesson for me or insight is something that isn't really mentioned in those books, but it's obvious that every individual is an individual. You know, they have their own individual problems, their own individual ways of working, their own individual ways of listening and learning and doing things. And, you know, they have their own family and their own environment. And it's very easy to forget that they're in their own world. They've got their own problems to go through when they finish work. They've got a family, and that family might not be going through normal stuff, and it's really easy to forget that kind of stuff. We've been reminded a lot of it over the pandemic, where, you know, everybody has had unique problems, whether it's, you know, having to look after the kids because they're not working from, you know, they're not going to school or not, or they've now got pets that they didn't have before. And, you know, everyone's going through their own life and their own journey at their own pace.
You know what, Dan, I think that, can you hear me? I think I'm still here.
Yeah, we just lost your video.
Really? Okay. Folks, I can still see myself, but it may be that Dan has gone, like my visual's gone from other places. Let me know if you can see me okay, if there's a problem. But I'm going to continue in any case, because I think you can still hear me okay. The idea that people are that have lives outside of work is probably something that we actually not only didn't know, but we kind of, there was an element where we actively kind of stopped seeing it. Do you remember, you know, some of the old management advice was that I received when I was an office worker, was leave your crap at home, hung. You know, you're
and treat
in the
everyone
office.
The same. And if you're a manager,
I'm not. I understand you have problems at home when you're in the office, you're working here, boom, boom, boom. And it was like, I don't care. Like, the management was purely a management of an on-site person in the office. But obviously, these days, like, there's the barrier between home and office is completely blurred. You can't, as a manager, afford to ignore what is going on in their lives. And usually the case, normal people, what's happening outside their lives is more important than what's happening in the day. And if you're not aware of that as a manager, then actually you're, again, not serving your business, because you're unaware of these other invisible inputs that is affecting a team member that then affects your team and then affects performance and so on. Really interesting. Let's talk about COVID and remote. I mean, Dean, you mentioned that you did get an office and you did, you know, move out of the wife's dining room. How has COVID sort of changed this? Have you guys gone back sort of to completely distributed, or is there an office still standing there and people come in? How have you negotiated this as leaders of the business?
Yeah, so we had three offices previously. We've now got two. We do not dictate to anybody that they must go into the office at specific days and times. It's a flexible environment. So, you know, if you want to go into the office and meet people, do it. Okay. But since day one of the lockdown back in last March or the March before that, we've been completely remote. You know, we flicked the switch on that Thursday or Friday, moved the VoIP platform pushed it to people's mobiles, etc. Everything we consume is online. So all of our apps and technology is online. I was the only one in the office for, you know, the beginning of that lockdown period, primarily because I'm sat there going like, well, I'm paying for it. I might also get some use from it. But apart from that, you know, it's we have the office just as a meeting place. If people want to come and meet and go out for lunch, then it's there. Otherwise, stay at home and do whatever's best for you.
You know what? I feel for you, Dean. I think there's a lot of CEOs that did go into empty offices, you know, with the proviso that either, you know, again, the pressure you're paying for it, but also the sense that, look, I want to be here in case anybody else comes in. I don't want them to feel the empty office experience. But you might just end up like rattling around inside like an empty space for a long time before you think, you know what, maybe that world's actually shifted like significantly to the point where these spaces need to be completely rethought and redesigned. Let's do some thought experiment on this. So leaving aside Tripad for a moment, where do you think offices will go? Or what do you think we're going to do with all of this space? There's people saying, oh, that we're going to have more of a WeWork again. The WeWork comes back and it's like multi-company, single space. Or maybe there's going to be retail and there's like all kinds of things commingled. Pubs might start having office spaces inside. Where do you think we're going to do with all of this space that we used to be prime like office real estate that these days is now like 10% capacity? What are we going to do with it?
Well, my hope is that people become more nomadic. And by that, I mean, if we're not restricted to a specific location because I need to go to the office 9 till 5, then why can't they start to move around and take advantage of, you know, different geographical regions, for example, or work while they're traveling? You know, what's to say that somebody working on a poolside or in a cafe near a beach can't be just as productive as somebody sat in an office? So I think the beauty of the pandemic for me is that it actually awoken a lot of businesses and people to the idea that they don't have to be inflexible and they don't have to be tied down to a specific location or time. And I think that's something.
That's, I think you're right in the sense it needed this exogenous thing because a lot of resistance to the idea. I remember, you know, again, it feels like a different world, a different era, but only 3 years or so ago, it was a radical thing to be working remotely. You'd be a strange person in the business that does this, or there'll be some sort of weird extraneous extenuating circumstance which gave you the permission for this to happen. And you know, if you're an in-office person and you wanted a work from home day or something, you'd need almost like a doctor's note or something, right? Mm-hmm. there'll be a process for this to happen. And now, of course, we realize all of it was kind of pomp and ritual, really, pomp and circumstance. What about the space, though? What do you think is going to happen to? Is it going to just be housing, or do we build a big park in the middle of London or something? Or like, what do we do with it?
God, there's so many things that can be used. I mean, we're from Sheffield. I mean, actually, we got some beautiful buildings in Sheffield, especially the older ones. And you know, there's a lot of redevelopment with those, even with those older buildings, turning them into city hubs for both living, working, and for eating. So you've got entertainment and work if you want, and you know, you can be at a desk in one of these nice buildings and just walk across the way and you get yourself lunch. I think there's going to be a lot more of those multifaceted hubs in the city centres. But I think also, I mean, certainly Sheffield and I'm sure other cities, they're going to think about what buildings they actually need and make them just reimagine the city centres and the buildings, either take some of them down that they're no longer needed, turn them into accommodation, or entertainment. You know, there's a lot of, we know that high street retail has been struggling for years, but there's loads of buildings there. People still want to go somewhere after work. People still want to go somewhere at weekends. So there's still a requirement for gatherings and people wanting to socialize. And I think what's happening now is we can create, or city centers and towns can create that experience 24/7 within the city center, not just, you know, not just have a 9 to 5 work and then go to the bar. You can experience that throughout the day.
Yeah, I think there's especially when you think about things like 5G, now 6G happening, that again unlocks the availability, right? So if you're able to actually, you know, take your computer, go to a park, obviously in Sheffield in the UK, maybe that's not something you can rely on. But I mean, you can, if you have an umbrella along with you, maybe you could. But that would give you, suddenly all the spaces become more available to you, and we can be more radical with how we think these towns and cities might emerge. But I think, yeah, there's going to be obviously a tough moment because we've configured the world where millions of people commute into the center and commute out. That world probably is going to disappear, and that would be painful for a lot of businesses, especially retail, restaurants, and so on. But I would hope that you know, we'll use the opportunity wisely to rebuild some of these city centers into spaces that actually people want to go to, irrespective of whether it's a working journey or not. You know, so yeah, very, very interesting. Okay, let's move on to talk about the. I mean, we talked about remote in any case. How has that affected product build? I mean, has there been any significant changes to how you've been thinking about Tripad as a result of this shift to a more location agnostic environment, or has it not really affected it so much in the sense that, you know what, it's not that relevant if a person is going to be, or a candidate is in office or not? Any thoughts on this?
I'd say from a product perspective, you know, we're in the online SaaS world, so it's all about, you know, being able to access platforms anywhere, anytime, any place. So I wouldn't say it's changed our views drastically, but what it has done, it's probably focused our attention more on what happens at the latter stages of the recruitment side. So when you're onboarding people, you know, we've had an onboarding module for a few years, but actually that's been a big success over the last couple of years, because people who did a, you know, had an analog onboarding experience before were forced into a revolution for them, and they have to have a digital onboarding experience. So it's definitely made us think more about how we can optimize that experience, not just for the recruiters and the line managers, but the candidates as well. And video's obviously been a big play over the last couple of years. So, but it's not that we've gone, oh, you know, now that everyone's going online, we need to do this. It's more a case of it's just focused our attention a little bit more on areas that we had, but have become more important.
Yeah, well, I think some of those modules you were talking about are suddenly now, maybe before they were like to have type things.
You know, people had a distaste for some of them, in 2 years ago, and now they're kind of, they're wondering how they live without them.
Well, I think the onboarding is so important. Like we previously had, I would say I'd been so reliant on a banging office to take care of the onboarding experience. You know, this is why we spent so much on these like premium furniture, great location, you know, all this like amazing type of spaces, because we thought, right, there's the wow factor, there's onboarding sorted out, the person's going to come in and be amazed, and then like we didn't think anymore about it. But actually no, because this person might actually never go into such an office again. How are you going to make sure this person feels fully aware, embedded in the business, and quickly feel welcome in there? That's not something that we're used to doing. So great that you already had a module in place, and I can absolutely see that being a more significant component in terms of, you know, vendors putting more resources to building that component into place, as well as of course on the front end with the video and stuff. Dean, I think you're about to say something.
I think it's the direction of travel has always been in this way. I think COVID just accelerated it. And for us, you know, the timing was right for us. We weren't too early this time. And I think the advent of some of the new technology that's turning up, you know, the Web3, the blockchain, the metaverse, all that kind of stuff, you know, that's going to be interesting over the next 3 to 5 years. And I think it's just going to consolidate more and more of flexibility, remote working. I think you're going to see employees becoming more choosy about where or who they work with. You know, we hear about, you know, Generation Z, you know, being picky about who they work with. I think more people are going to become pickier.
That, again, would feed into some maybe product ideas as well, wouldn't it? So maybe the ability for employers to differentiate themselves using ATS-type products. I mean, can you do that properly? Again, you look at some of the more legacy platforms out there. You know, everyone's got multi-job posts or automated job posting into different spaces. And you look at some of the older technologies and you think that really is going to impact the conversion. Like, if the experience is so bad, that people just going, you're just asking people to just trawl through mud to get to this point. That's uncompetitive. Like, it's actually a big component that you can no longer neglect. So I think the shift to remote is certainly going to impact some product design thoughts and what have you. Let's look at sort of what's the down the pipe for you guys this year, 2022. I know you just got the new product person on board. Big part of their job is going to kind of realize a lot of this. But and you already mentioned that, you know, you're very much product customer led in terms of your development cycle, but are you getting any signals from the customer base as to what sort of things need to be built? And if so, can you tell us a little bit more about what you maybe a customer could expect if they're using Tripad at the moment? What's down the pipe for them in 2022?
Yeah, so I'll touch on a couple of things. You'll know this better than a lot of people, but there's a big push for contingent workforce and the increase in use of a contingent workforce, contractors, be it temps, piecemeal project work, that kind of stuff. So we built a contingent workforce platform that can be used as a marketplace for specific skill sets. That's been used though during the course of the pandemic, actually, for recruiting locums for local GPs, locums and nurses, helping administer vaccines and the like. So yep, that's just one use case, but we know that that product can be used and is used in different scenarios, whether you're building talent pools for contractors or for projects. One stat, every stat you read is different in a different article, but you know, in the US alone, you might see stats of about 60-odd% of workforce in certain industries is a contingent workforce or contract. So we do see a big increase in that type of mixed workforce. So you've got a really interesting dynamic coming of not just remote work but remote contingent work. Our products are evolving into that space too. We're building more into our integration ecosystem. So we've got an ecosystem of, you know, many, many dozens of partners, nearly about 100 or so partners that can plug into Tripad in any way. We're building out that framework more and looking at opportunities where not just Tripad products could make use of that integration framework, but other products, be it ours or other companies' products, could potentially make use of that that framework. Obviously, talked about onboarding. That's still a key area for us. I think helping customers source. You know, when you ask customers or any recruiter what their biggest problem is, it's always sourcing is number one. Tripad's had tools since day one to help with that, but it's definitely an area where we're looking at how we can make that even easier for recruiters, finding candidates on a plate and candidates finding jobs on a plate, you know, bringing that together much more seamlessly, I'd say.
Yep. It sounds like lots of stuff happening, and I think particularly about this idea of a much more diversified workforce in terms of their contract type is going to be a big component for ATS builders, because basically people who've built technology that are servicing, that basically where the unit is an individual, human capital type information, the default's always been like a permanent on-site employee. That's the thing that we've optimized for when we're building ATSs. That's what we're thinking, right? The mental image is that this person is going to go from being a person on the street to a permanent full-time employee in the business, sitting in an office at the end of that process. But if we're saying now, oh, 20% of the workforce will never be in the office, and actually they're not going to be permanent employees, they may just be oscillating in and out of the business based on company need or whatnot. Is this system optimized for that? The answer is no. So the opportunity is huge for companies that are able to get in there. I think all ATSs are building towards this. So it's going to be an exciting space there to see a different sort of product solutions. But I also think there's going to be external kind of operators entering into the market, dealing specifically with this and thinking, you know what, we've always dealt with this kind of fluidity, we can do a better job. So there may well be new market entrants coming in as well. Okay, let's have a look at this ATS space. We can say it is fragmented, always has been fragmented. Why is that the case? Like a lot of people come to me, which is the best ATS? No one can give actually a consistent response. It's because there's like hundreds, maybe even thousands of products out there that suit this space. Now, why is that the situation? Have you guys got a theory as to how why the fragmentation is there? Dean, you got any thoughts?
Yeah, every business seems to have their own unique process for recruiting people. And they're very prescriptive and locked into that process. So they want their ATS to just do that. So when you've got such a vast range of requirements from end users, you end up with a vast range of solutions. So there aren't many off-the-shelf products that, you know, people are selling and say, it just does that. Okay. And then you have to bend your process to do that. So I think, you know, that's the primary reason. We're seeing sector-specific functionality. So hospitality is different to construction, different to, you know, finance. So you're seeing some demarcation across sectors. And again, it's that blend of the workforce. You know, is it full-time permanent or is it contingent only or is it a mix of the two? So again, all of those permutations and combinations pretty much drive the sheer number of solutions out there. I think we're going to see consolidation in the marketplace, though. And I think we're going to see complementary products. So Dan mentioned, you know, the integrations framework. This is one area where we see there's going to be a lot of work over the next couple of years. So enabling third parties to share data between themselves and do business or interact between each other for the benefit of the client. And the client may not be ours, but it may be somebody else's.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think there's still going to be lots of ATSs out there, but we will start to consolidate into a standard industry-wide type of use case or framework, because otherwise we're just going to get lots and lots of small players bubbling up with a small solution and just won't be able to compete long term.
Yeah. I think you're absolutely right. Those micro differences, there could be like one law, for instance, that governs construction, but that law will basically make that management of those candidates completely different. Therefore, you need a bespoke solution for that particular industry. We haven't even talked about geographical differences, obviously, with different labor laws and, you know, how
do regulations,
all that regulation. So I think you're right. The fragmentation is understandable. And even those like big global operators that say, this is our solution, we operate multi different countries, chances are under the hood, they're actually different products in many respects that simply have the same badge on the top because they still need to be compliant with local regulations and be sensitive to those local demands. I am excited to hear about this framework though, guys. I think that's a really exciting moment. I think a lot of businesses have struggled to identify a kind of a middleware tier that can kind of, you can trust to move data in between systems in such a way that it is safe that is compliant, but it can be useful. And I actually don't know of many products that are out there that have done it. I think there's companies that have tried to do it, but they've ended up pivoting into something else. So there's obviously like a barrier to this in some way. But yeah, it'd be wonderful to see an emerging product out of the UK that would do something similar to that. We've got just a couple more minutes left, folks. I want to just go back really to some personal inputs. There's a lot of people out there, recruiters in particular, are I think very entrepreneurial people. They're driven in this way. A lot of them might be thinking, right, I'm starting a business. Do you have any like business advice for first-time founders? Like, what is the thing that you've seen that this is something that people make a mistake on, and this is why they fail? Don't do this. Do you have any of that kind of negative advice, like the don't do this X? What are your thoughts, Dean?
The one from personal experience would be don't burn yourself out. So sleep is really, really important. Otherwise, you'll just get yourself into this downward spiral. And in the early days, you've got lots of energy and enthusiasm, but that can soon take over and you just end in burning yourself out. So I think, if I was to go back in time and talk to myself, it would be, qualifications aren't important. As somebody who stayed at university for 13 years, I didn't need to do that. Okay. All I needed to do is read some decent books and get out there and make some mistakes. And that would have shortcut my learning process probably by about 10 years. And then it's come up with a plan and then make sure that you get plenty of rest. Because when you're fully rested, you're more creative, you've got more energy, and it's the right type of energy.
You know what? I hope you're paying attention there. There's some brilliant insight there. So I spent too long in education as well, not nowhere near as long as you, but definitely an extra year or two more at university than I should have done. And whilst it was great and you can learn a lot through academia, nothing beats experiential knowledge. You've got to just go in there. It's almost like learning how to cook something by reading a book. You have to cook the damn thing. You have to turn the hob on. And I think starting a business is that way. You've got to you've got to get in there and make the mistakes. You've almost got to kind of have a way to anticipate mistakes you guarantee to make. You're going to make these mistakes, but just build resiliency into the system in some way so that, you can cope with those early knocks. So I can very much roll toddlers trying to walk for the first time or babies trying to walk for the first time. You're gonna crash down and scrape your knee. That's what's going to happen. You want to do that as soon as you can, but make sure you don't break your bones. That's one of the things that you need to know. And I love the advice on sleep as well, like self-care. There's so much pressure for young entrepreneurs because you might have gone out there, you've cut your revenue off immediately, you left your job, let's say, and you've got pressure that way. You may have made an announcement to your friends and your network to say, I'm doing this. All that comes with pressure, but you can overwork. You absolutely need to understand that your body itself is not a infinitely beatable thing. Like, you've got to take care of it. It's like a very, very important part of how it works. How about you, Dan? Any advice for proto entrepreneurs out there? What should they not do?
Well, I think don't be afraid of changing your plan, because what you think you're going to do almost certainly won't be what you end up doing exactly. So, you'll have a product vision in mind, but your product in a year's time won't be what you thought it would be, when you first started. You have to listen to your customers. Do not ignore your customers and do not ignore your buyers. You just won't have a product. You'll have a product. You just won't have any users.
So yeah. Yeah. Listen. I think I can totally be sensitive. At the early days, my failing kind of companies, when I started off, this is what I did, overly committed to a vision. This is how it's going to be. And then, no one was buying. It was like literally no one was buying. 18 months, not a single invoice. And I was like, oh my goodness, I'm going to go bankrupt here. I was like, do I sell the property and fund the business this way? And I had to stop myself and say, Hong, if you're going to do that, guess what? 18 months down the line, you're going to have no house. And also, Also, you'll be no further forward. There's something wrong with what I'm doing. It doesn't fit to the market. You've got to figure out that first. And once I had that revelation, it caused me to really pivot away. And thank God I was able to, you know, reverse that really quickly and make that loss back. But yeah, you can be, that's inexperience. That's inexperienced entrepreneurship. Now that I've done it, it's like, yeah, totally. You can't, you may love an idea, but it's like experimental. You have to have a disposable attitude to it. Your job is to service the needs of the customers. And your idea is your first idea is a vehicle to get to those customers. And if they're saying they don't want that, then you know what, you've got to change it to something that they suit. This actually leads us back to one of the questions that came into the thing here. I want to just deal with this because Michael, who himself, by the way, is launching a cool product, which is, so he's a founder, he's on this journey. He said, look, okay, devil's advocate, customer-led product growth. Do you ever have to build what they don't tell you? So what's he on about here? Rather than incremental innovation, going out and building something they could never thought of. So I think what Michael's saying is, if you kind of are customer-led in terms of product development, aren't you reliant on them to be innovative? And you know, maybe they're not that innovative.
Yeah, I always come back to this, the Ford quote. You know, if I asked what my customers what they wanted, I'd have given them a faster horse. I think what I've said, I still stand by, you know, you got to listen to your customers, but they're not always the people to think what's next. They're more interested in, you know, how to solve the problems that they have today. So we do think about the problems that they're probably going to have tomorrow. And that's where, you know, we've made mistakes in the past where we've got things wrong, where we thought, oh, this will be a problem, so we try and solve it. And some of those things just haven't happened. But we're an innovative company. We're techies, you know, it's what we said at the beginning of this. We like to create stuff. So we'll always be those kind of people that want to try things out. But the premise of your business can't be not listening to your customers and just doing what you want. But you've got to innovate. So you can't, that can't just be the premise of your business of I'm only going to do what my customers ask for, because that will leave you in trouble in 5 years' time. Just doing that.
Yeah. And you'll end up being basically a software house more than anything, effectively an outsourced development team, which is a totally viable business, by the way, but it's a different type of business than a product led business.
It is a challenge for any tech business is trying to find that balance of making sure you do something that people want and need now and tomorrow versus what they're going to need in a year or two or more's time.
Maybe one way to think about it is that the customers do the problem discovery for you. So they will tell you what the problem is, but how that solution manifests is your responsibility as the builder. Like they would know where the pain point is. And your job is not necessarily to take their product advice, but there is to identify there's the pain point. That's worth trying to think around a solution on this and does this work? And that's where maybe the optimal relationship between the two is. Okay, cool. Listen, Dean and Dan, we're coming to the end of the show. So let's leave it with a final thoughts on this. You're two busy people, obviously. After sort of Founders Focus is over, what's on the table? What's happening the rest of the day for you? Dean, are you watching TV again or what?
No, I'm on Zoom calls in 2 minutes' time with clients. Until 2:30, and then I'm gonna have lunch.
Right, fantastic. How about you, Dan? What are you doing the rest of the day?
I've actually got a meeting about our a manual for our contingent workforce platform.
Fantastic. Okay, well, let me let you get on with those important things to do. I want to thank you both for joining us on Founders Focus. It's been fascinating, hasn't it, folks? Just to learn from how it is to build recruitment technology businesses. So Dan Kirkland and Dean Sadler from Tripad, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone.
Wasn't that great? I thought that was just so fascinating. I really do enjoy doing Founders Focus. It's so interesting to hear from people that have really taken a bit of a risk, building difficult solutions, building a company is no mean feat. And you can learn so much from people who have gone through that process. So if you're interested in more of these, we've got them all lined up. I think there's another three already. We're going to speak to the CEO of Guide, Candidate Experience Platform. We're going to speak to the CEO of Talent Protocol, exciting Web3 platform coming out of Portugal. We've also got a CEO of Talentier as well, which is a new RPO coming out of Denmark. It's all there. Make sure you follow the channel, everybody, because that is where you're going to get hold of all of these shows. Okay, that's about it. What am I going to do this afternoon? I'm probably going to go for a walk. It looks quite nice out there in London, doesn't it? So I will see you around later on. By the way, Brain Food Live is happening this Friday. Make sure you tune in for that. We're talking about TA transformation and how to sell it to the business. So we'll see you there.